today. Why up to a million Uyghurs, a minority Muslim group, are being held in massive internment camps in China. And Bella Mackey talks about the transformative powers of running.
So I was walking through some villages and I had this location that I was looking for. I had coordinates for it and I didn't really know what it would look like. And I get to this corner and suddenly I see it.
What does it say on the taxi sign?
It's a massive complex. There are these tall white walls that stretch as far as I can see. And on top of them, these circles of what's either barbed wire or electric fencing, and every few meters, a row of surveillance cameras. There are police, some of them with these kind of long batons. And there's a police car that keeps driving just up and down the road. There was a group of people standing across the road in front of these little shops and a woman selling skewers of meat and vegetables, but nobody was talking with each other, nobody was buying anything, nobody was doing anything except for just looking at this massive building.
If we just ask this woman?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah.
You know, as I went up to people and tried to ask them what this thing was that we were looking at, nobody seemed to know, even though obviously they were there waiting for something. People would sort of shrink back and didn't want to talk and wouldn't make eye contact. You know, that's when I realized that I had arrived at this place that I was looking for, a re-education camp.
China may call these re-education centers, but Amnesty International calls them detention camps. The Chinese government says it's tackling extremism among a minority Muslim group known as Uyghurs. Others paint a much darker picture. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what's really happening to up to a million Muslims being held captive in China?
So a re-education center is a detention facility. Activists and critics of the system will call them prisons. China would call these training centers.
The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief, Lily Kuo, has recently returned from reporting in the area that Uyghurs are being detained.
But according to people that have been in them, some of whom we've interviewed, people whose family members have been in them, activists and researchers, they are places where Muslim minorities are sent and they are re-educated, as in they are taught Chinese propaganda to change them into obedient, patriotic citizens. They have to learn Mandarin, they have to learn patriotic songs, they have to constantly praise the Communist Party and Xi Jinping. There's no trial, there's no due process, and they're not told when they're going to be able to leave.
They're locked inside.
Right, so the one that we saw, you could see bars on all the windows, you could see surveillance cameras inside. They're heavily guarded, they're watchtowers, there's barbed wire all around. And people that we've talked to have described them as places where you're basically controlled the whole time that you're there.
How many camps are there?
The estimates range between 200 to 1,200.
And the numbers in them?
There are as many as a million Muslim minorities in these camps. So that's mostly Uyghurs, but also ethnic Kazakhs, Hui's, Kyrgyz, and some other minorities too.
So tell me about the Uyghurs.
The Uyghurs are very different from Han Chinese people. They look different, they speak a different language, and they're in the far northwest of the country.
In a region called Xinjiang.
Right. Xinjiang is the largest region in China. I mean, it's massive. It can fit the size of the UK, France, and Germany, and then some. It has about 20 million people. About 15 million of them are Muslim minorities, and most of them are Uyghurs. And pretty much since the founding of the People's Republic of China, the government has been trying to control this region and establish sovereignty over these people.
So China says it's dealing with a threat of terrorism from separatist Islamic groups.
At least 21 people have been killed in fierce fighting in China's troubled far west region of Xinjiang.
There were riots in the region's capital in 2009 in which many people died.
Security forces in Xinjiang province have reportedly shot dead 13 people after they drove into a police station and set off an explosive.
Since then, there have been terrorist attacks, including a car bomb in Tiananmen Square that Xinjiang separatists claim responsibility for.
Right, authorities here are calling it an act of terrorism, striking in the heart of Beijing, right in Tiananmen Square, which in many ways is the symbolic heart of China.
Then the government said Uyghur terrorists were to blame for a knife attack at a crowded train station in which 31 people were killed.
A confrontation involving knives, axes and guns ended with a house being burned down in an act local authorities have blamed on terrorists.
The Chinese government says its security program is an essential part of the war on terror. But human rights groups argue that the violence has stemmed from oppression, and they say an attempt to target a few militants has led to a needless crackdown on an entire community. Lily, what's the situation for the Uyghur today?
At the moment, the Uyghurs are under intense control and threat of being sent to one of these camps and also a series of other measures. You know, Communist Party volunteers come and stay in their homes and they don't really have a choice in that matter. They have to check in with the police. They have to go to flag-raising ceremonies. Anytime they go to a different village or township or leave the city that they're in, they have to go through lots of checkpoints where they go through full body scans. Their phones are put into a machine and scanned for any content that's deemed questionable or extremist. And within the areas where they live, they also, as they're walking down the road, they'll be stopped and their phones will be checked. So, you know, it's not just the camps. It's just a constant surveillance state.
While you were in a village in the region, you came across something called the Red Star Family Program. What is that?
Apparently the system has been in place for a while, but I hadn't heard of it until I walked around this village and saw that pretty much every house in this village had this sign up. And then I asked a propaganda official about it, and he said that it was these 10 requirements, and I looked them up later, and they were things like patriotic spirit, counter-extremist thought, and then another one was like an understanding of the value of money or making money, which I thought was really interesting.
What do those signs look like?
A little kind of metal plaque, and it has little red stars on it, and it's in Uyghur and in Chinese, and it says that this is a model Red Star family.
So an entire community, an entire religion is essentially being subject to methods of suppression and surveillance.
China will say that it's not about a religion and that it's about extremism and extremist thought. But then it will describe certain behaviors as extremist, like going to mosque or praying too much or wearing a veil.
Going to mosque is included in extremist behavior.
Going to mosque too much, so praying too much. So in the county we went to, the local government had just set up a live feed surveillance system in all of the mosques in that county. And so when you go into the mosque, you have to register your ID card. So nobody really wants to go. We spoke with one woman who was in a detention center in Urumqi, and she said that a woman there said that she was there because she had sent a happy Eid message to people on her phone. And so a lot of people we spoke to who were outside, a lot of them would have on their profiles things like, I love the Communist Party, and sort of Chinese flags or different patriotic backdrops, because they thought that that might help them out.
So on the one hand, this is about making you incredibly patriotic, but it sounds like they're very much trying to squeeze religion out of people as well. I mean, is it a form of ethnic cleansing?
It's not so much trying to get rid of a people and kick them out of a place, but it is an effort to completely assimilate them and to then basically erase their culture and language and to sinicize them.
And to what extent do the camps fit into this? I mean, how are they targeting people?
The reasons that you can be sent to a camp seem to really vary. So one woman said that she didn't have her ID with her. Somebody else we spoke to said there was no reason. Other people said that they were there because of music that they had found on their phone or messages, or somebody had told authorities something about them. Also, it can be based on quotas. So in a particular area, those local authorities will just grab people.
What do we know about so-called re-education inside these camps?
People describe being forced to learn Chinese for lots of hours, being forced to learn patriotic songs and recite parts of Chinese law and pledge allegiance and praise Xi Jinping and the Communist Party. You're monitored the whole time that you're in. Even when you're sleeping, every room has a surveillance camera and you're not allowed to turn your back to it, basically, as you're sleeping.
Oh my God.
We know that there are some instances of violence and torture inside the camp. So there have been cases of sleep deprivation. One detainee that we spoke to said that he was put in something called a tiger chair for 6 hours. This metal contraption that forces you to stand with your arms and your legs out. And this ex-detainee, he had a very difficult time in the re-education camp he was in, and he at one point even tried to kill himself by ramming his head into the wall.
So you've been reporting in the area, you've seen these camps from the outside. Did you get any sense of how people get out and when?
So the area that we went to, there were two compounds on each side of a highway. And the compound that I described that was this massive kind of prison-like facility, that one I was told people are there for years, that's a long-term one. And then the other one, I noticed that there were people outside of it and they were there to see relatives inside. And I was also told that that particular facility was kind of a lower intense one where people could come home for a night on the weekend, but then on Sunday they have to go back.
And what's the consequence of all of this for the local communities?
For the local communities, we could sense it when we were there. People were terrified to talk to us. And one man that we spoke to, he was too polite to tell us to leave. And I felt really actually awful about it because as he was talking to us, then in the middle of it, he said, you know, I'm scared to speak with you because they'll retaliate. I think it's also very difficult for the communities outside of China because they're trying to find out what's going on inside. They're separated from their families. They're trying to find out what's happening to them. One person that I spoke to, he was one of the few in his family that had a passport and was able to leave the country. And he begged his mother to go with him, and she wouldn't go with him because she couldn't leave the rest of his siblings in Xinjiang by themselves. Before they parted, she said to him, you know, maybe this will all blow over in a year or two and then we can meet again. And he said, I hope so. But he told me that he really doesn't think that that's going to be the case. He has to live with that decision that he made in leaving his family behind for the rest of his life.
Does the story get reported in China?
So for a long time, China wholesale denied that these camps existed and said, you know, there's no such thing. And then in 2018, they kind of changed the narrative and have started to whitewash these camps. And so now they emphasize this aspect of them being vocational training centers and say that this is part of a poverty alleviation program to help the local residents. So there's an effort to make the camps look normal and sound like they're basically summer camps, that these are places you can play basketball and all the dorm rooms have air conditioning and people learn skills. And then after they come out, they're employable.
But you can't come out until they let you out.
Right. And you don't have a choice of going into them.
Lily, China's a difficult country to report from, isn't it?
Yes, I would say so.
Can you describe some of the challenges to us?
So I was here between 2008 and 2010 and then just came back this past July. And even between now and then, I can tell a difference. People are much less willing to talk. There is a lot less public debate. When I was here before, you could call an academic, you could speak to a person on the street, and people would offer their real opinions about things. And I used to say back then, China's not this police state that people think that it is. But this time, I feel like it is moving that direction, and more people that we try to talk to, they can't talk or something eventually happens to them when they try to. So that is difficult, is trying to speak to people, trying to find out what's happening and do that in a way that doesn't risk these people, their safety.
Yeah.
We were stopped when we were driving by in a taxi, and guards at the camp saw me in the car, and I guess I had my phone, and he thought I was taking a photo or a video, and he yelled. Our car stops, and then suddenly just a swarm of police just descend on us. And then they took my camera and were asking what I was doing and made me go into this police station that was part of the camp. I was surprised by how quickly these local government officials from the, they said they're from the propaganda department, came and kept asking me, you know, who did you speak to? How long have you been here? How did you get here? And they kept asking, who did you speak to? And what did you talk to them about? And of course, I didn't want to say anything because it's very dangerous for people there to speak to foreign reporters or speak to foreigners and communicate and transmit any information. And that's what makes reporting there so difficult. They eventually let me go. You know, they said, we don't have anything to hide. We welcome reporters here. It's just that you need to register with the officials in the nearest city in order to report it, which is not true, actually. And they said, and you know, and for your safety, we will have escorts for you for the rest of your time.
So the Chinese government argue that they are trying to prevent extremism in a vast region. Are there other narratives out there about why this is happening?
Another narrative that speaks to the country as a whole is that the situation in Xinjiang is part of a broader worsening human rights situation in China. And so under Xi Jinping, the space for dissent, the space for activism has shrunk dramatically. And so some people would say that the situation in Xinjiang is, you know, just a symptom of that, and that kind of worryingly, it's an example of what methods could be used across China.
So not necessarily directly linked to the riots or the attacks that have taken place.
Right. It's more about control.
And to some extent, Xi Jinping is trying to present China in a much more modern light on the world stage. When we talk about him meeting foreign leaders, the focus is always on the economy or trade. Do you think the world is turning a blind eye to what's going on in China?
It does seem to be the case that countries are hesitant to say things about the situation because of their trade relationship with China or because of their, you know, diplomatic relationship. But the situation does seem to be changing in the last year as there's been more reports about what's happening there, and the UN has made statements and various human rights groups have made statements. So now governments are also starting to push for accountability and push for access to the region to see the camps and see what's going on. Unfettered access, not just these government organized tours. So I do think that it's changing.
And while we all wait for international pressure on this story, what about the Uyghurs themselves?
I think the scale of this goes beyond just what's happening right now and what's happening to the people that it affects. It will extend into the future. I think there will be a generation, if not more generations, who are psychologically traumatized by this. And it's definitely one of the worst human rights situations in the history of China.
Lily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lily Kuo's reporting from her recent trip to the Xinjiang region has been published, and you can read it at theguardian.com. Coming up, Bella Mackey on coping with anxiety. Now, writer Bella Mackey describes her deteriorating mental health and how jogging made a huge difference.
I always had panic attacks in crowded places and in sort of places where I couldn't see an obvious exit. And I think that's very common for lots of people who suffer with mental health problems. And so I'd found it sort of increasingly hard to go into lots of parts of London. There are lots of things about anxiety that sort of dominate your life, and including kind of huge amounts of adrenaline in your body all the time and a brain that you can't switch off. And running, for me, is a chance to shut my brain up. The fact that you are out there in the world doing something on your own gives people who are anxious this kind of big boost of confidence, which, you know, quite often people with anxiety don't have much of. I started running up an alleyway in the dark because I thought people would laugh at me or think I was doing it wrong, I found gyms really intimidating because they all look like they know what they're doing. But I did feel quite impressed that I'd managed to do something different and on my own. So I sort of, I've just carried on doing it, and I downloaded the Couch to 5K app and made my way up to, you know, running 5 kilometres in one session. I think it takes about 8 weeks. And by that point, I just thought I could fly. Like, I just thought I'd developed this kind of new magical skill. It gave me the confidence to go to places because I thought, well, I can get myself out of here. I'm sort of the master of my own route in a way. I thought it had worked so well for me that it would be quite interesting to see if it had worked for other people and sort of share some of my experiences. I spoke to people with a variety of different sort of issues, from mental health problems to, you know, bereavement and separation. And I think the one thing they all had in common was this kind of incredible determination to fight through it and make themselves better somehow, you know. And for lots of people, that meant medication and therapy. And they were all looking for something else, like an extra thing that might be able to pull them through it. And for all of these people, it was running. The reaction to the book has been really overwhelming. I've had hundreds and hundreds of messages from people telling me their life stories and sort of explaining all the problems that they've had, and lots of them saying running has helped them too. The reaction I get the most is, oh, you know, your book made me feel less alone. I don't think running is a cure. I don't think there is a cure for anxiety. For me, it's one tool in a toolbox. So, you know, therapy, medication, supportive friends and family. I started running into places deliberately that I knew I would find scary. Like, I ran into Soho, or I ran into, you know, St. James's, where all the tourists are, and the Houses of Parliament. From that, I realised that, you know, there wasn't very much to worry about. The city was not my enemy. It seemed so impossible that I could do that. I stopped having panic attacks because of that. I would hate for anyone to think, oh, she's written a book about anxiety and she's sorted, because, you know, I'm not at all. I have much better days and more of them, but it's a long-term journey, and running for me is something I'll sort of try and do all the time, because with mental illness, recovery takes quite a lot of work.
That was Bella Mackey, whose book Jog On is out now. That's it for today. This episode was produced by David Waters, Lucy Greenwell, Amar Kalia, and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Ivor Manley. The executives are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.